and doctor student at law school.
Corina Di Gennaro, I'm a fellow at the Berkman Center.
Lokman Choi, Berkman Fellow and PhD student at the University of Pennsylvania.
Doris Audet, staff at Harvard Law School Development Office.
Steve Helfer, staff at the library, Harvard Law School Library.
Gavin Lee, Harvard Law School Leading Scholar.
Maury Kahn-Levitt, documentary filmmaker and web designer.
Bob Wolf, retired but also a part-time consultant to not-for-profits online communities.
Robin Mohammed, Sociology Department, Columbia University.
Edmundo Barrios, research fellow at the Center for International Development at the KSG, Kennedy School of Government.
Susan Hackley, Program on Negotiation here at Harvard Law School.
Adria Goodson, I'm the Director of Domestic Programs at Hunt Alternatives Fund, and we run programs that support social movement leaders.
I'm Amelia Cohen, SHIPS Collaborative, and I'm also an activist.
My name is Ben Mazzotto. I'm a PhD candidate at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
I'm Rusty Tannard, also from the Fletcher School.
Joe Green, Facebook Causes.
Sarah Nunn, doctoral candidate at the High School.
Marshall.
Marshall Gann, teacher at the Kennedy School.
Tammy Smith, assistant professor of sociology at SUNY Stony Brook.
Thomas Haghammer, my fellow at Harvard Kennedy School.
Ben Rattray, founder of change.org.
Can you guys in the back quickly say same thing?
I'm Vijay, Law School Library.
I'm Caitlin Wagner, I work at Hunt Alternatives Fund.
I'm Shari Abrams, I also work at Hunt Alternatives Fund.
Arietta Chagos, Harvard Kennedy School. I'm a research staffer on disaster recovery and community resilience.
I'm Jason Chulanda from the Harvard Kennedy School, the Asian program.
Mark Pachecki, I'm a graduate student in the Harvard Sociology Department.
Charles Goodell, Harvard College 08, site of computer science, and former management consultant at NASA last month.
Seth Cotta, I'm a PhD student in health policy.
Mark Lewis, with the college.
Great. One last time, if any of you guys want to sit at the round table, there are plenty of seats. And feel free to move up throughout the presentation. I'm not going to say much by way of introduction. Just to say that this is the in a workshop or a set of panels that's full of betweenness. This is the most between panel, and I think what we will do is work down the panel from Marshall all the way down to Ben. And Ben really could fit on the third panel as well. And so the idea is to just fluidly move into the next section, but fluidly. Marshall's gonna start by talking about his experience in and scholarship on social movements and the role of narrative in social movements. And hopefully we'll see a natural transition. Tammy Smith does social network analysis, but also takes tools from social network analysis to look at narratives. And Thomas Haghammer is a fellow at the Belfer Center who has looked at the rise of Islamist movements and also addresses this question among people who study Islamist movements about whether or not people are drawn into those movements by their social relations or whether they're drawn in by ideology first. And he's actually been working, I know now, on looking at online videos and the narratives that they contain that are meant to sort of spread Islamist movements or continue their rise. And then finally, Ben Rattray works for change.org, founded change.org, and I think is going to talk about the way in which change.org originally thought about being a social networking organization and then switched to a blogging platform which was much more narrative driven because the narrative was necessary for drawing people in, just as Marshall will probably say, but now that change.org has had quite a significant success, they're able to reach out and use social networking tools to build on the success of the social movement, which was about identity and narrative. But I could be completely wrong, that was just an introduction, and we'll hand you over to Marshall.
Okay. All right. Good afternoon. Are you here? Hello?
Hello.
All right, just checking to see if anybody's
out. So far, so good.
Yeah. Is this, all right, good. So, thanks for the opportunity here to learn, because I think that's what I'm gonna be doing is learning about the exciting interface between old wine and new bottles and kind of what the pour is going to look like. I think that I'll begin by saying something about social movements, leadership within social movements, the role of narrative as a leadership practice, and how they interact. And hopefully that'll set some ground from which we can build. Social movements, of course, are a form of association. And I've always been, actually continue to be, impressed with de Tocqueville's observations when he came here in the 1830s and studying American democracy, and was concerned very much about the problem of individualism, which he thought was a major challenge in France. And he discovered the rich associational life in this country and found it very encouraging for three reasons. One was because the act of association drew individuals out of their own little silos and sometimes parochial concerns into relationship with other people through which they would learn and could learn about common interests. So in other words, the notion was that common interests were not simply an aggregation of individual preferences. Common interests were the result of learning that goes on when individuals interact with one another, and there are venues for that kind of interaction. So the synergistic quality of associationism was one very important dimension. Secondly, at least theoretically, the promise of democracy is that equality of voice will somehow balance inequality of resources. It's honored more in the breach than in the practice. But the significance of people coming together around common interests is that they can then pool their resources to act together on behalf of those interests. So then it becomes secondarily a way of mobilizing power. And thirdly, because these associations were voluntary, people participated in them and participate in them not because they're going to get fired if they don't, not because they get put in jail if they don't. In other words, freed of coercive and of political and economic forms of both coercion and incentive, they're far more reliant on the values that move people to volunteer and commit themselves and engage. And as such, they serve as a certain kind of crucibles for values renewal, because otherwise they don't exist and they won't operate and you can't get anything done. So now social movements, as I understand it, emerge as the result of efforts of purposeful actors, individuals or organizations, to assert new public values, form new relationships rooted in these values, and mobilize the economic, political, and cultural power to translate these values into action. So I'm distinguishing social movements from fashions, styles, fads, viral or otherwise, in that they are collective, they are strategic, and they're organized. Now, their influence and effect often transcends formal organization because they have this powerful cultural component, which is the power of the narrative and the story that they tell. But they don't take shape, they don't accomplish purpose, and they don't really operate very long in the world without becoming organized. They differ from interest groups, though, in that they focus less on allocating goods than on redefining them. Not only winning the game, but also changing the rules. And social movements are initiated usually in response, as a hopeful response to conditions deemed intolerable. The participants make moral claims based on renewed personal identities, collective identities, and public action. In the United States, they've been major drivers of social and political reform since even before the revolution. And perhaps looking for models, perhaps most usefully in the Great Awakenings and in the sort of models of moral and religious reform that often kind of set the pattern for social movement mobilization in this country. So that's what I'm thinking about when I'm thinking about social movements. And of course, other people, I'm sure, may have other notions, but I just want to be clear what the animal is that I'm talking about. Now, leadership. In my experience, you don't make social movements without leadership. But what do I mean by leadership? Here's a definition. Accepting responsibility to create conditions that enable others to achieve shared purpose in the face of uncertainty. Now, let me repeat that. Accepting responsibility to create conditions that enable others. In other words, I'm not describing leadership as the glowing star in the sky that illuminates with its brilliance, but rather as a social practice of engaging with other people. It's purposeful, to achieve purpose. And the final condition, which I think is probably very, which is very significant, which is uncertainty. When everything's working very predictably and we're following routines and everything, what do we need leadership for? I mean, we have management systems and that's fine. It's when things break down, it's when the unpredictable happens, that's where the adaptive and creative challenge that is the particular venue of leadership is required. And so it's exercising, it's enabling people to achieve purpose under particularly challenging conditions, that is novel conditions, conditions that require creative response. So now social movements almost by definition are such things. They're new, they challenge the ways of doing things, they have a deep uncertainty, and therefore they make great demands for leadership in order to be able to function and do what they do. Now, unfortunately, social movements are also often associated with, well, there is this one leader who then articulates the cause and then everybody follows along. It's far more of a myth than a reality. There are certainly powerful personas able to articulate and communicate the mission of a social movement, otherwise no one would understand it, hear it, or become engaged with it. On the other hand, there are anything but one. If you take a look at the civil rights movement, Dr. King's form of public discourse was in fact practiced by thousands of people across the South. He was just very good at it. And out of the black church and black fraternals and black unions came a whole cadre of leadership that operated at multiple levels. In fact, social movements require a critical density of leadership because they are so decentralized and they have to deal with such novel conditions and uncertainty. So arguably, in a command and control organization, the demands on leadership are far less than in what Richard Walton described as commitment organizations, where the requirement is dealing creatively and innovatively with novel circumstances in many different locations, sometimes called distributed leadership. So social movements really are models of distributed leadership. And what they do, as I've come to understand it, is five tasks. There are five leadership tasks. I'm not talking about personality. I'm talking about the practices required for a social movement to operate. The first is bringing people together around shared values, and that's, I think, the narrative arc. I'm going to come back to that. Second, bringing people together around common interests in the form of relational commitments, lateral relational commitments, commitments people make to each other to work together to achieve common purposes. Thirdly, structured collaboration, whether in the form of leadership teams or whatever structures are appropriate, but structures are very necessary. Fourth, strategizing, the creative transformation of resources into outcomes. And fifth, action, actually making things happen on the ground where it really goes on. The demand for leadership is also particularly acute because social movements are usually dealing with a situation in which there is an injustice, there is a grievance, there is an abuse. But there is also the requirement for hope if action is to be possible with respect to that abuse or grievance. Walter Brueggemann, the Protestant theologian, wrote a book called The Prophetic Imagination, where he talks about prophetic vision as consisting of two elements. One, criticality, which is a clear appreciation of the world's pain, suffering, and limitations. And at the same time, hope, recognition of the world's possibilities, joys, and probabilities. People don't act to make change without hope. On the other hand, they also don't act without provocation. When Dr. King describes the fierce urgency of now in his March on Washington speech, lots of people remember the dream part, but they forget the nightmare part that preceded the dream. And the nightmare and the dream converge on action. And so the particular challenge that social movement leadership faces is mobilizing action under those kinds of conditions and circumstances. Now, so what's narrative got to do with this? Well, my understanding understanding of narrative is that the subject of narrative is agency. That the core mission of narrative is that it teaches us, it is the way in which we learn how to exercise agency. Now, what do I mean? Agency meaning exercising choice under, guess what, conditions of uncertainty. In other words, we exercise agency not when everything is all, you know, worked out, we're just following the rules. It's in those conditions of uncertainty, when we don't know. It's not clear. We're called upon to deal with novel kinds of challenges. That's where agency matters. That's where we actually have choice, can exercise choice. And it is a moment that is both exhilarating and frightening, because it's uncertain. And narrative, I argue, is the way we learn how to become agents, how to exercise agency. And let me just explain a little bit more about this. The second sort of part of this argument is that the exercise of intentionality and intentional choice occurs under certain emotional conditions. First of all, we don't begin to exercise agency unless we experience some anxiety, unless we experience some need to break out of the habit. I mean, habit rules, right? And we just kind of do what we go along driving on autopilot until the truck pulls in front of their car, or until a bear walks in the door, and we're confronted with something we have to deal with that we're not expecting how. And that confrontation we experience as anxiety. And anxiety then causes us to pay attention and to say, oh, I better deal with this. Sometimes a similar kind of provocation can be, so in the context of social movements and social mobilization, urgency is often a stand-in. Urgency is often what precipitates that kind of attention and anxiety. Ooh, it's got to happen next week, now. Anger is another one, where the dissonance we experience between the world as it ought to be, as we believe it ought to be, and as it is, provokes an indignation, a kind of like, this isn't right. Now, those experiences then get our attention, but then the question is, how do we respond to those experiences? Now, if we respond fearfully, and if we're in a fear mode over here, we're much more likely to protect ourselves, to withdraw, to strike out, or to freeze. Not very productive responses to a novel challenge. On the other hand, if we are in a hopeful state, we are far more likely to, our curiosity is much more likely to be provoked. We'll explore, we'll get more information, and we'll begin to learn how to deal with this novelty. So it's kind of a crucial question whether we experience anxiety from a fearful or hopeful position. Similarly, if we experience the challenge of novelty in an alienated way of being, it's quite different than experience it empathetically, where we're conscious and aware of the social surroundings in which we find ourselves. And finally, if we experience it from a place of self-doubt and a lack of confidence or self-efficacy, we are likely to respond very differently than if we can respond from a place of confidence or trust in our capacity to deal with it. So the argument here, and this argument is made at greater length by George Marcus in a book called The Sentimental Citizen, is that there are emotional conditions that facilitate intentionality and agency. And in the absence of those conditions, it's very difficult to achieve intentionality. That's it. And that, to me, is a lot what agency is about. So now, where does narrative come in? Well, narrative does the emotional work required to exercise agency, especially critical, where uncertainty or where conditions of uncertainty are very great, or where one's agency is in question. And let me explain what I mean by that. The core structure of narrative, I understand to be plot, character, and moral, and setting. A plot, as I understand it, consists of really three elements. What initiates a plot is, guess what, an uncertain challenge, a source of uncertainty, a sort of the unknown, you know, we sometimes say it's conflict, but it's actually, it's, the plot begins, I came over here from the Kennedy School, not a plot. I tried to leave the Kennedy School to come here, but the door was blocked by an elephant. An elephant in Kennedy School? Well, okay. Now, it's absurd, but it did get a little twinge of interest. The point is that what makes a plot is the unexpected. And that's when we pay attention. That's when we begin to get engaged. And the reason why we get engaged at that point is that as agents, as human beings, the texture of our experience is full of having to cope with uncertainty, whether in small ways or big ways. I mean, marriages break up, people get thrown out of school. On the other hand, the theater may be sold out of movie tickets and we have to choose another movie to go to, and oh my God, what happened to the parking? And anyway, so big or small, part of what characterizes our experience of the world as conscious human beings is this experience of uncertainty and not knowing what to do. It seems like what that has done is created infinite appetite to learn how. And what the plot does is recreate that situation. Oh, uncertain. And we begin to lean forward. You really have to ask yourself, what is it that you're trying to get from leaning forward? It's not simple entertainment, it's learning, I think. Now, but because the plot, okay, so this challenge then confronts a protagonist. And the protagonist then is confronted with needing to choose, needing to act in some way in response. So there's a choice there. And then the choice the protagonist makes produces an outcome. And then from the outcome, we learn a moral. Now, let me go back to the protagonist for a minute. Protagonist, because it's a person or person-like entity, we're able to empathetically identify with the protagonist. Because we're able to empathetically identify, we get the emotional, the affective content of the situation, not simply its conceptual content. We get that there's courage, there's fear, there's hope, there's love. We are able to enter into the affective reality of the moment. And because of that, we're able to learn affectively, not simply cognitively, from what's occurring. In other words, stories don't just teach the head, they teach the heart, which is one of the reasons why most of our faith traditions and cultural traditions teach through stories, because they have that capacity. So the moral that comes out at the other end is not simply something like haste makes waste. The moral that comes out is the experience of haste making waste, so that we learn experientially, not simply conceptually. And, you know, so we deploy stories and use stories quite purposefully. And if you've ever been at a party where somebody started telling a story and they just went on and on and on, and sooner or later somebody will always shout what?
What's the point?
Yeah, exactly. Because we tell stories to make a point, to cause something to happen in the world, to in some way influence action, influence the world, influence those around us. So the work then of, oh, and finally setting. Stories are told in a setting. And I emphasize stories are told because they're a form of social transaction. They're not simply a set of words on a page. You know, when you're telling a story to someone, you're empathetically reading their response, right? And their eyes begin to glass over. And you say, ooh, maybe I should add a couple of zeros here, you know, kind of make this little bigger deal. Or maybe that fish was just a little longer, because you're not getting the effect. See, the story is not true or false, it works or it doesn't work. And so the test of a story is whether it works at conveying the emotional, the affective meaning that you're trying to convey through the story. And so that occurs in different kinds of settings. Now, story in the context of social movements and leadership has a particular burden because social movements very often are all about creating agency where there has been none. When powerless communities mobilize in order to try to improve their circumstances, they are often dealing with the problem of having lost agency and trying to claim it. They make enormous demands, not only conceptual demands, they make the demands of motivation. They make demands on hope, on courage, on risk, because change doesn't occur without risk and without uncertainty and without being able to handle questions of sacrifice and trust in others and so forth. Just won't happen that way. And so stories then go beyond simply knowing what's appropriate to do. They actually help us acquire the capacity to do it. It's like St. Augustine described the difference between knowing the good and loving it as the source of moral action. So when it comes to public stories and the role of leadership in social movements with narrative, then am I okay on time? Should I, am I over time?
You're good, no, you're good.
All right, thank you. What I've learned is that really it takes a three-part form. Maybe it's four or six, but it seems to take a three-part form. There seem to be sort of three dimensions that come into play in social movement stories and stories told by social movement leaders. And actually, the first place you can find it, is in the conversation in Exodus between Moses and God when Moses is minding his own business with his sheep, and he sees this light, and he steps off the road to investigate the light, and he sees this bush is burning, and the voice comes out or whatever and says, Moses, you know, you're called to do this. And Moses' very first question is, so we have any biblical scholars here, very first question is, why me? What's this got to do with me? Who am I qualified? I'm not qualified to do this. What are you coming to me for? The second question he asks is about, well, wait a second, who are these people and what have you got to do with them and what do I have to do with them? And thirdly, he says, couldn't this just wait a little bit? I mean, I really got to do it right now? And of course, he's given a brother and a staff and a whole bunch of incentives to do it. Now, that basic formulation of why me, why us, and why now is a framework for understanding public narrative, for understanding narrative in the context of social movements and public leadership. You don't have to go back to Exodus. You can also go to the first 7 minutes of Barack Obama's Democratic Convention speech in 2004, and you'll hear exactly the same formulation. You will hear Obama begin with stories about why he has been called, where he has come from, what are the choices his parents made that influenced the person that's standing before us. And then secondly, he reminds us as a nation of what we are called to, beginning with the Declaration of Independence and so forth. And then finally, he confronts us with the challenge required for action now in the form not of regression analyses or statistical presentations, but rather in the form of a series of small stories about the lives of people's lives who have been disrupted by the lack of opportunity for education, for employment, and so on and so forth. But he couples that challenge with the hopefulness that in the end, people will know what to do. It's very interesting the way he pulls that off, and then confronts us with the choice. And of course, the choice he offers in that talk is to vote for John Kerry, which that part didn't work out. Or maybe it did work out. I guess it depends on your point of view. But the formulation of self, us, now, and the specific formulation of challenge, choice, and outcome in the third term of the story is one that seems to be somewhere in the deep structure of the ways in which social movements and leaders of social movement construct stories. The story of self, this first part, one can think of as a reflection on the choices one has made in one's past, and retrieving those moments of choice and retelling them in such a way that listeners can experience something of the significance that those choices held for you. So it's not just like a resume, which of course Obama did not do. It's going to specific episodes, moments, and of course you know we're gifted with episodic memory, not simply semantic memory, and that is what gives us this capacity for storytelling. And it's rooted in the power of visualization, so the more visual a story, the more powerful the story, because it enables the listener to enter into the affective reality that's being communicated there. So, and really, if you're in public life, if you don't tell your own story, John Kerry found out what will happen. What will happen is that others will seize authorship of your story from you, and you'll lose it. Now, the story of us, the second piece, is a particular social movement art because, you know, we're all part of multiple us's. But what constitutes an us or a collective identity is also shared experience. People can work together in a workplace and go to work and come home and sort of be on some kind of graph. They would look like they have a common identity, but in reality they don't, because no one is doing the work of telling stories of their experiences, interpreting their experiences as a narrative sequence that results in a shared identity that holds, lifts up particular values that that group shares. And you know what I'm talking about. In any group that you've been part of, there's the storyteller. And there's that person who, and they're doing the identity work, because they're constructing the narrative, and the narrative communicates the values that constitutes your group. So what social movement leaders learn to do is to tell stories of us, and often drawing on well-established stories of us, like faith traditions, like the Exodus story, which transmutes all over the place, cultural traditions. So that kind of cultural innovation and adaptiveness is what constitutes a story of us. And finally, the story of now, that I think is one of the best examples, is Dr. King, the March on Washington, the Fierce Urgency of Now speech, but there's many, many others. So my argument is that social movements in particular are not simply sets of relationships, they're not simply strategies, they're not simply a set of practice of actions in the world, they're not simply structures. They're narratives. They are new narratives, or sometimes they're new and old narratives blended, that do the work of crafting the new identity that this social movement is forging and forming. And part of the power is that it does individual work as well as collective work. In other words, it's micro and macro. And what's typical of social movements is that they're not just about transforming the world, they're often about transforming ourselves. And that connection between the two is made by narrative. So I think I'll just conclude by saying I am really interested to learn how this works in the context of new media. I do know that one of the things we learned in the campaign, and I should just say that we trained people in the campaigns, in the Obama campaign, we trained people systematically in public narrative. I mean, that was what we taught people how to do, because they would come to a training session thinking they need to learn Barack's biography, or thinking that they needed to memorize every policy statement in the world and have all the answers, and say, no, no, no. What we're gonna start with is why you're here. Let's start with your personal story. What got you here? Why does this matter to you? And do the work necessary to equip people to, as Charles Taylor puts it, articulate their moral sources. Because that's really what this is about. It is articulating one's sources of value. And as Taylor argues, when you are capable of articulation, then you actually are empowered by that value source and able to engage and motivate others in ways you can't when you're simply moved by it, but not articulating how and why and what that means. We would teach people how to do that, how to tell their stories of self. And of course, one of the trademarks of the campaign were personal stories all over the place. What I saw was, what I was surprised to see, and I think others were, the power of YouTube. YouTube was enormously powerful in the campaign as an educational device, as a motivational device. And think about it, what does it do? It shows pictures, it shows people in action. It enables an empathetic relationship that simply is very difficult to achieve through words or signs or other symbols, although symbols sometimes do it. I took that as a kind of interesting thing. So I'm very interested to learn so what can you do? What can't you do? And what does this mean? Because for me, it always still comes back to carpenters. In other words, building a house is a matter of having a vision of what it's gonna look like and a weight and an understanding of what it takes to build it. The best hammer in the world doesn't a carpenter make. And starting with hammers and trying to figure out what they can do may be a little backwards. And I think one of the strengths of the campaign was that it really didn't have a new media strategy, it had a strategy. And it drew on online, offline elements in such a way that they could build, they could envision a house and then build it in the most useful ways they could. Thank you.
Tough act to follow. So the last thing you just left off was new media, so I'm actually leaving that to these guys at the end. And I actually focus on sort of unpacking ideas of the narrative, so I'll sort of be speaking more to that aspect of working on narrative. I always feel like a deep amount of pressure to tell a good narrative myself, so hopefully we'll accomplish that as well. And I think the link with social movements, I don't work with social movements per se in my work, but I think the link here is we have, you know, these sort of groups of people that come together, as we've heard, like under conditions of uncertainty or risk, and to sort of propel them into action, they need not only the sort of the why me answer, but then also the how us or the story of us, which has also been referred to as sort of participation identity within a social movement. And Damon had cited Roger Gould's work on the French Commune, and I think he pretty explicitly sort of maps this out, that in order to get people to sort of enjoin in these kinds of actions, they need to sort of see themselves as participating in a community. And with that notion of community in mind, my interest in social networks and narratives stems from my own work in trying to understand how societies begin to repair the torn social fabric after wars. Wars, you know, we not only bring about physical and material trauma or destruction, but that's the kind of stuff that we're used to seeing on the nightly news, right? Like the burned out homes, the sort of waves of refugees coming out of a place. They not only do that, though, but they also set in place other kinds of legacies that make state building and peace building extremely challenging. And here I'm talking about things like the erosion of social trust, and then the creation or transformation of particularistic identities, whereas before you may have had a more inclusive group identity. Wars have a tendency to sort of pull that apart a little bit and crystallize identities into being much more particularistic. And relatedly, they also polarize notions about the past and recent events. And if states are to begin operating again after wars, one of the assumptions of my work is that citizens need some sort of way of sort of creating or accessing sort of cross-cutting ties, ones that aren't just sort of within your own group, but sort of cut across these groups. They need to begin to find a way to start doing that will bind them all together, however loosely, into one state. Otherwise, you're left with things like 1960s Cyprus, or present-day Bosnia or Kosovo, where institutions of the state support a division of a boundary between former combatants or between communities by providing the platforms upon which particularistic identities not only persist, but actually thrive. So my work is really interested in looking at how state institutions can also sort of start shaping these kinds of things and set in place these things. So implicit on my work on identity then is this assumption that there's this correspondence between networks of social actors, the stories that these actors tell, and the institutions that provide the space for storytelling. And with institutions here, I'm talking about things like education systems, political systems, refugee camps, assistance centers for IDPs or internally displaced people, churches, mosques, synagogues, cultural organizations, all these sorts of things can be sites of storytelling about the past and our recent experiences. And earlier, David had noted that action is both top-down and bottom-up. And I think that narratives come out of these top-down, bottom-up processes as sort of artifacts of these sort of combined pressures of top-down and bottom-up. Within my own work, my questions relate to whether, getting back to sort of idea of institutions, whether certain kinds of state regimes, like democratic sort of democratically oriented states or authoritarian states, whether certain kinds of regime types make the evolution of a non-particularistic identity more or less likely. So if you, you know, have a democratic system that sort of set up things after a war, is it more or less likely that you're going to have polarizing, particularistic identities emerging out of participation within these institutions? Conversely, if you have an authoritarian state, are they better or at worse at curbing narratives about internecine violence that may sort of act as catapults into further violence? Now, to do that, I felt that I needed ways to examine change within actors' narratives about the past. And what I came to realize pretty quickly was that narratives, much like social networks, are merely sets of relations that link together elements that ultimately create the entire story. And they do this by sort of structuring the parts of the element, the parts of the narratives in a certain way. So once we conceive of narratives in this very structural way, you can see the possibilities of adapting the same tools that the discussants in the first panel were talking about for social network analysis to the study of narrative in order to examine various structural properties of narrative and to test assumptions about narrative change. And I wanted to do this because I wanted to try to find a way that would make my assumptions about what certain events mean and the sort of relations among them more transparent. So I wanted people that were reading my accounts not to sort of accept it because I'm telling a convincing narrative myself, but because I can actually demonstrate using these like social network tools what's linking to what, and over time how these different links change to create changes in meaning. So today, hopefully, in my brief talk, I'll begin to sort of just inch toward the shallow waters of this new method for analyzing narratives. So what do I mean when I say that the structure of narrative allows us to see story parts as network relations? Well, I think, first of all, it's probably good to start from the definition. And so, you know, we can say a narrative is an account with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the events within this beginning, middle, and end are arranged in some sort of temporal order through a plot, and that this temporal ordering implies something about causality. What happens, what has to happen in order for something else to happen next? So when we read or listen to a narrative, it usually appears, as you sort of see on the screen, it usually appears as this very direct A to B to C, right? Now that accounts that I work on about violence around World War II, people that are in the region that I study would say, well, you know, before the war under fascism, life was kind of difficult. So it'd be like point A. And then the partisans arrived and, you know, there was this like regime change, point B. And after that, you know, life got to be pretty good. We had more social justice, social equality, life was pretty good. So although our narrators tend to tell stories like from A to B to C, we really need to keep in mind that when we're telling stories, we're actually telling them retrospectively. We start with C and we work our way back. Right? We already know the ending of a story before we begin it. And that this knowing the end of the story, knowing where we're going, then sort of creates the structure. It sort of creates the sense of where the story goes. So the other thing that comes out of like looking at narrative structurally is that oftentimes we have far more elements in any given story about some event than we can actually muster. I mean, think about really terrible storytellers, right? They're terrible often because they give you like extraneous details, they go on and like horrible tangents that don't really seem to relate to any kind of point. And as you're sitting there and you're listening, as we said before, like, you know, you want to ask, like, what is your point? Because you're all over the place. So to be a compelling storyteller, you need to have some sort of selection mechanism to help us choose the best parts of the story for a given narration. And that's also about setting, right? So what works in one setting to be sort of compelling for making your point may not work in another setting. And if we look at the slide. Since a lot of this stuff is kind of not all that intuitive, I mean, that the point A to B to C is kind of intuitive, but in fact, these other kinds of choices within the narrative, I think, are sort of help with the illustration. So, you know, the narrator telling a story, it looks like A to B to C, but what you realize is that certain kinds of elements within the narrative, certain events, certain turning points within the narrative, connect in different ways to other parts of the narrative. Right. So here we start with A, and ultimately we get to G. Now the story, again, like of my the region that I study, a lot of people left after World War II from this region. So a lot of what I get are accounts of leaving or being forced out. So if we take G to be the account of I left, and A, you know, I start off in my place, I need to explain why it is that I felt compelled to leave. And here you see, you can use events in D or E, and D may be, you know, my kid was forced to go to a school that I didn't agree with, or I couldn't get my identity card from the municipal office, or, you know, local thugs were extorting money off of me in order to, you know, for protection, to sort of stay in my home. You could use multiple different kinds of accounts to get to the same end. So these kinds of stories are transposable, but they all sort of funnel in to the same narrative endpoint, which is I left. And that's in sharp distinction to point F in the network, right? If you hit upon F, unlike D and E, where you can only go to G, right? You're compelled to sort of tell that kind of story. When you hit upon F, this whole range of narrative options opens up to you. And so you realize, like, if you go from F to H or F to J, you're going to land up telling quite different kinds of stories in the end. So by looking at relations among within a narrative, you can see that there may be some parts of the narrative that are more susceptible to narrative change or open up possibilities for narrative change. And my hunch is that things like F would be most likely to sort of produce that kind of narrative change. Now the other thing about structure too is oftentimes when we have sort of pre-existing narratives that we're relating to, we call these things sort of master narratives, right? They sort of are these frames upon which we read ourselves into. And the master narratives, I think, my hunch also is that they have fewer links, right? They sort of compel us to tell a certain kind of story. And at what point do narratives after wars, as we're trying to sort of form a cohesive identity, as we're searching for ways to tell a common story, how do we get that sort of agreement upon the account of what happened? How do we get that master narrative where things aren't willy-nilly all over the place, but where we all sort of agree within a certain limited range upon what happened? So, yeah, these kinds of things, these choices, started me thinking about, like, whether the differences in the structure of relations would correspond to the likelihood that meanings of events can change over time. And drawing upon sort of Wendy's example from before, she's talking about things like centrality. And my hunch, again, was that once you have a master narrative, you're going to have more events pulled into sort of like the central part of your narrative. You're going to be telling kind of the same, you know, if we were all sort of participating in a social movement and we were all sort of buying into that identity, if someone asked us to describe why it is that we joined or what's the purpose of our group, if we had a master narrative, we would sort of be accessing the same sets of stories to explain that. Whereas if it was a sort of group in formation, and I think one of the questions too is with the sort of ability to join through new media, and you don't have like these sort of tight relations that reinforce stories, are the stories that people tell, are they going to be much more diffuse? Are they going to be much more heterogeneous? And then what does that do to the sort of durability of identities? So, you know, are certain structures more or less vulnerable to changes in meaning, or are others more durable and able to fend off change? Are they more entrenched? So one big question, now I've taken you down a sort of esoteric path into narrative structure. One question is, why does this matter? Like, why do we need to know about the structure of narratives? And I think it matters for things like trying to move past the divisions of war to rebuild a state, and for citizen security within that state, for their ability to exercise sort of fundamental human rights and freedoms. Prior to the PhD, I had a career as a human rights analyst and a development practitioner. I worked in Croatia during the war and in Bosnia for years after the war. And we all watched, like, helplessly while the structure of the state and the institutions that were set in place continued to polarize and fragment the peoples of the region. Every election saw inflamed rhetoric. Every newspaper account reporting upon refugee return was seen from at least two, if not three or four different lenses that radically altered the meaning of the return for the respective audiences. And all of us working there worried over Bosnia's future, if its people could ever begin to build some sort of shared understanding of the past, and how are they going to do this or conceive of a shared notion, not just of their past, but of their future. And I looked around for historical cases in which such a common future of sort of building a shared understanding off of deep rupture and deep trauma. I looked for a sort of historical case that would actually give me hope that this kind of thing was possible, because when you're working day to day and then receiving all these reports of human rights abuses, seeing how they're reported in the news and seeing then how that gets translated into things like political party platforms immediately, like in elections immediately after wars, you think there's no way to get out of this almost like hamster wheel of these cycles of violence. But in fact, actually, I didn't have to look very far for a historical case where such common future building occurred. It was actually in Croatia, right next door. And it's a region that borders Croatian region that borders Slovenia and Italy, that saw massive violations of rights and really deep trauma before, during, and after World War II. And the amazing thing about this is when you go to that region today and you try to get people to actually talk about, you know, what's the sense of your history, they'll tell you a history of cooperation, ethnic tolerance, and generally getting along. And I thought that, you know, when I first actually went to the region, I didn't know about the World War II stuff. I thought that that's what their history was. And in fact, for them, it is. And they're pulling from actually things that happened. They're not making stuff up. They're just being very, very selective about the history that they choose to act upon. And it worked for them. They stayed out of the 1990s war based on this platform of ethnic tolerance and harmony. In fact, they formed the only viable political opposition to hardcore Croatian nationalism. They're the only place where my ethnic Serb friends feel comfortable going on vacation in the region. And so it works in a very kind of durable way. It's been tested even in the Crucible of War, where they haven't sort of fragmented and fallen apart. Kind of surprisingly, maybe, right over the border in Italy, where a bunch of people who used to live in this region fled to, all you hear about is the violence. It's a complete narrative of victimization. So within 20 kilometers, within same families, you have brothers and sisters living on opposite sides of the boundary. You have cousins, you have, you know, just from the same family, border goes down after World War II, divides families, and part of the family begins living in an authoritarian regime, the other part in a nascent democracy. And so it's this nice little social experiment for me to actually see how institutions of the state help structure and structure narrative and deal with problematic memories and moving forward. And the sort of counterintuitive thing, you know, we believe that democratic institutions kind of give us the best hope for things like conflict resolution and for dealing with human rights violations. But the counterintuitive thing is that maybe democratic institutions immediately afterwards aren't such a good idea. Maybe you have to wait for those kinds of cross-cutting ties that animate the democratic process to sort of get established first and take root. Because what I find in my case, this border area case, is that in Italy, they do harbor deep resentments still under this narrative of victimization. And it plays out in concrete political ways where you have, like, the neo-fascist movement is alive and well living in this region in Italy. They've managed to sort of work through the EU to try to keep Slovenia out of the EU, and then eventually now they sort of work with trying to put conditions upon Croatia's entry into the EU based on 60 year ago problems. And just over the border, their cousins are actually talking about cooperation and coexisting, and sort of, it's a more future-oriented kind of narrative, not a past-looking kind of narrative. And so this sort of, it brings about some sort of fundamental questions, not just about narrative structure that I'm interested in, but also about if we have these sorts of understandings about what has to happen in order to have narrative change. And if we know that narrative, the ways that we tell stories, is also associated with the groups that we're acting within, and that we ourselves carry these stories forward, then we have to be looking at the kinds of institutions that we're putting in place after wars, and what the likely outcome 5, 10, 15, 50 years down the road is going to be for rebuilding communities after the devastation and violence. So I think I'll leave it here, and thank you.
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me to the seminar. It's fascinating for me because I think I'm probably the strangest animal in the room, and that I come to this from a completely different background in research on violent movements, particularly jihadi movements or Islamist movements. I know almost nothing about the social network literature. I know a little bit more about the social movement theory literature, but I'm compared to most people in the room, I know nothing. So my work has been very empirical for a trained political scientist. Although I'm technically a political scientist, what I really do is a sort of a mixture of ethnography and sociology and religious studies. I've spent a lot of time in the field in places like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, talking to former militants, semi-militants and their relatives, etc. I've also spent a lot of time reading radical Islamist literature. I read their texts, and have been doing so for many, many years. And third, and perhaps most relevant for this discussion, is that I follow very closely what's going on the internet, on the sort of the jihadi corner of cyberspace. Well, I spend 2 hours every single day for the past 8 years plugged onto these jihadi websites and follow the discussions on the discussion forums as well.
That's good.
Which alias do you use? I actually blog about this as well on a blog called jihadica.com. That's jihad and ICA. Just a cheap way to intellectualize a fairly mundane activity. So I come to this from a different background. And I see my role here is really bringing in observations from a type of phenomenon and type of movement or network that differs from the ones studied here, or the ones that you know well, in two particular respects. First of all, in being violent and clandestine, and that's very high risk. And secondly, by being of primarily non-Western origin, as you probably know, the social movement literature deals primarily with cases of non-violent movements in Western democratic contexts. So I think it'll be interesting to see some of the same dynamics are at play in the people I study. And I'm going to be fairly brief. I'm going to talk about two key debates in the terrorism studies field or literature that I think have relevance for this discussion. The first one is the debate over the relative role of social networks and ideology, i.e. what comes first, social connections or ideological convictions. And the second debate is that over the significance of the internet. In both these debates, the unstated dependent variable is individual radicalization and mobilization to violent activism. I should stress that I'm going to be talking primarily about transnational anti-Western militancy of the Al-Qaeda type, the 9/11 type, and this is often referred to in my field as global jihadism. I say this because there are many different types of Islamist militancy, and many, if not most, of these actually have more local and limited aims than Al-Qaeda. But the global jihadis are interesting because they represent the most extreme end of this Islamist spectrum. And this is a type of activism that involves inflicting mass casualty violence, and it usually demands a lot from the participants. It usually demands the ultimate sacrifice. At the same time, there is overwhelming evidence that material grievances are not very strongly correlated with participation in jihadi networks. The link between poverty and global jihadi activism or state repression and global jihadi activism is not very clear at all. But most people tend to agree that ideology must play an important role in this type of mobilization process. But there is considerable debate over what this role is. And one key question that has been debated in the past 5-6 years is what comes first, connections or convictions? For a long time, the dominant view in the terrorism studies field was that ideology or convictions preceded connections. And this view still is predominant in some circles. And the assumption behind this is that the religious nature of this ideology or these narratives meant that there were already in place spaces for socialization or institutional socialization spaces for religious activity of sort of more mundane character. Mosques, religious schools like madrasas, universities in Saudi Arabia, etc. And that people with particular religious inclination would gravitate towards these socialization spaces and form connections with similarly minded people and eventually radicalize. Another key assumption was that the sheer increase in the quantity and the reach of ideological propaganda, jihadist propaganda from the 1980s onwards, meant that almost anybody could come into contact with this ideology and be infected by it. You'd be surprised to see how often the epidemiological analogy is used in this literature. I don't think it's very fruitful, but it's there. The idea being that once you're sort of exposed or infected with the ideology, a person would then gravitate towards radical circles and then eventually militant groups. The problem was that more and more research and I'm talking now about the early 2000s, more and more research showed that jihadis did not come from these socialization spaces that I mentioned. They were not madrasa students, so they were not particularly frequent mosque goers. In many cases, they were what you might call born-again Muslims who had led relatively secular or sinful lives, only to sort of suddenly change their behavior. So people started questioning this ideology first hypothesis, and then I think the most influential refutation of this argument was articulated by Mark Sageman, who's a psychiatrist, who wrote a book called Understanding Terrorist Networks that some of you might be familiar with. And he showed that for the vast majority of jihadis, connections preceded convictions. He showed how people were drawn into radical circles through their acquaintances, through relatives or neighbors or people in their for friends at school, etc. That only later were ideological convictions clarified and reinforced. And he coined, I think, the term the bunch of guys phenomenon, or BOG, as he called it. And he also articulated a sort of dictum that's often used in this literature that in-group love is more important than out-group hatred. So these people didn't join the radical communities because they had such a hatred for America or whatever, but rather because they sought some sort of emotional things that they could find in a bunch of guys, in a group with a bunch of guys. So, of course, this was not a new argument. Mark Sageman didn't invent this. This is exactly what David Snow and others were saying 25 years earlier. But Sageman was able to convince a different crowd, I guess, mainly by using new data and to show that the connections before convictions was true even for extremely ideological and radical movements. Now, the Sageman idea gets us quite a bit further in explaining differential recruitment, I mean, why some people become militants and not others. But it doesn't get us all the way. I mean, there are some problems or limits to this perspective. It doesn't tell us, for example, why some networks radicalize and not others. Also, any given individual will have a large number of connections and some superimposed networks. Why is it that only some of a person's connections are mobilized in these processes and not in others? And I think it's fair to say this theory kind of glosses over the role of individuals, the fact that some people, some individuals are more ideologically driven than others, both before, during, and after entering into this type of movements. And on this latter point, I think there's some very, very interesting research being done at the moment where people try and look into sort of more inherent inherence of certain elements of this, inherent characteristics of individual actors or inherent characteristics of certain sort of narratives or frames or ideologies. But without going into essentialism. For example, there's a Norwegian scholar called Petter Nesser who has studied jihadi networks in Europe and has shown that there are generic features to the composition of personality types in terrorist cells in Europe. That is to say that in almost all terrorist cells in Europe in the 2000s, a particular combination of personality types recurs. And he identifies four ideal types of personalities. He talks about the entrepreneur, who's sort of the driver, the most ideologically committed, and the most, usually the most charismatic, the most, and the one who has the most intellectual resources. He talks about the protege, someone who's very, very close to the entrepreneur, and also has intellectual capital. The third ideal type being the misfit, and someone who is into this sort of activism for more material reasons, or because he or she has gone through some trauma or whatever. And then the fourth type being the drifter. He argues that in any terrorist cell in Europe, you would find an entrepreneur, one or more proteges, one or more misfits, and one or more drifters. And I guess this ties in slightly with Galvo's idea of there being special people that are particularly important for the formation of this sort of movement. And in this case, them being the entrepreneurs. Another fascinating line of research, in my view, is one being pursued by an Oxford sociologist called Diego Gambetta and a Paris-based political economist called Stefan Hertog, who have looked into why engineers are so overrepresented in militant Islamist groups. This is something that that many people have observed over the years, but they actually sit down and look at it very systematically and collect a lot of data to prove it. They prove that it is a fact. They are overrepresented. And they offer two main explanations, one being social mobility closure in the Muslim world. So in most Muslim countries, engineers have very high expectations because it's considered the most elite career path. Yet they're unable to find jobs because of the various structural economic reasons. But the second explanation is what interesting here, and that is they argue that there may be a certain engineering mindset. And the idea here is that an engineering professional, the choice of an engineering profession is just a proxy for a particular mindset characterized by two things. One, a sort of desire for clarity, for semantic clarity, and the second being a penchant for social conservatism. And this claim is obviously very controversial, but it is fairly well supported, particularly with a lot of quantitative, a lot of survey data from the US, actually, among college students, which show that engineering students are usually much more religious than students in other disciplines, and they're also much more conservative. There are several other data surveys to sort of back up this idea. A third little line of research is one that I'm engaged in, and that's looking at ideologies and narratives and trying to identify ideal types of ideologies. And I've argued in the past that there are such ideal types, and that there are particular dynamics associated with each of them, and the best example being the ideal type difference between nationalist type ideologies and revolutionary type ideologies, which is the same as horizontal and vertical ideologies. The idea being that when a group that a group that sees its enemy as being outside of the community, then you're dealing with the horizontal nationalist type ideology. A group that sees the enemy as being inside of the community, that is a revolutionary or sort of vertical type ideology. And there's, in my view, overwhelming evidence to suggest that nationalist type ideologies have sort of more mobilizing power. They attract more people, they attract socioeconomically more diverse followers. So it may be that certain types of, certain ideal types of narratives have a higher ability to transcend networks. They're more transferable in a way. Just briefly on the second point, on the role of the internet. There's been a lot of talk about this in my field recently because Islamists have started using the internet extensively from about 2002 onward. And I should say here that as was pointed out earlier, we're still in the experimentation phase. The study of the internet and radicalism is still in its infancy. So what I'm saying here is as much my kind of speculation as what's in what has yet been articulated in the literature. The assumption that the internet has a sort of role to play in mobilizing people for jihadi activism is, as mentioned, based on this spectacular increase in the use of the internet by jihadi groups. You see, this started in the late 1990s, but from 2002 onwards, it's really exploded, both in the number of sites and the number of users. And the number of sites is actually not the most important here, because it's the type of sites and the number of sites on each individual place that matter. You've seen the emergence of a few very, very influential and very frequently visited discussion forums where all kinds of jihadi propaganda, textual, audiovisual, is distributed, and where people can discuss politics, theology, and all kinds of other things in real time. And there's a clear trend towards more audiovisual material being distributed as digital cameras have become cheaper and the bandwidth has increased. And I think it's fair to say that the internet clearly has empowered existing groups. It allows for the distribution of information among followers much more quickly and more cheaply than before. It allows for a certain amount of secrecy in the organization, etc. But the question really is, to what extent the internet can generate new activism? And the question of whether the internet alone can generate mobilization. And indeed, a lot of people have, and this is, of course, the intuitive position, that the internet can generate new activism simply by making propaganda available to so many more people than in the past, and by providing this sort of communication platform in which connections can be forged. So it kind of has a dual, and the internet would seem to play have a dual function here in generating networks, creating connections on the one hand, and distributing ideology, distributing narrative. There's been a big debate in my field over whether the internet alone can generate activism. And this, of course, stems from a security concern. It's really about the extent to which one can expect spontaneous terrorist cells to emerge in the West, by the mere fact that anyone can download jihadi propaganda from anywhere. And so from this you get this talk about homegrown terrorism, etc. And a lot of people argue that that the internet can do this, and they point to a few cases where people have gone from being completely unmobilized to carrying out acts of violence without having come into contact with members of Haida or people in the movement. They point, for example, to the Mohamed Bouyeri, the guy who killed Van Gogh in filmmaker Theo van Gogh in the Netherlands. They point some point to the Madrid bombing in 2005 and to the fact that to this day we haven't really seen clear connection between the Madrid cell and Al-Qaeda central in Afghanistan. And you also have cases of people going from zero to becoming extremely, extremely important and active distributors of jihadi propaganda and facilitators in this virtual world. There's a famous case of a Moroccan son, the son of the Moroccan ambassador in London, actually. He was very, he was a very prominent figure on the jihadi internet under the alias Jihadi 007. And he did not have physical, face-to-face contact with any established militants. But but other people, and I think a growing number of people are saying no, that the internet's ability to mobilize people from scratch is very, it's very limited, actually. And that the majority of cells that have emerged, even after the internet was introduced or became important, still involved a significant element of face-to-face contact. And for the most dangerous cells, the radicalization process also involved training, military training, and that's why people, that's why so many militants even today seek out areas where they can train, like in Iraq or in Pakistan or elsewhere. I think one of the reasons why the people. So many people believe that the internet could mobilize people from scratch was an analogy that some people drew between the training camps, Al-Qaeda's training camps in Afghanistan in the 1990s, and some of these internet sites where people distribute information about tactical and operational matters and where this propaganda is distributing. People were saying in 2002 that, well, first of all, I should stress that the training camps in Afghanistan is widely seen as the as the most important reason why Al-Qaeda has such strong reach and a strong operational capability. Because in these camps, people would be recruited in various ways from around the world and come to these camps. And in the camps, extremely, extremely strong social ties were forged by virtue of the fact that people were exposed to hardship together. They were isolated. Many forged new identities, etc. And so these camps not only train people militarily and so on, but they generate very, very strong social connections. And this was key to Al-Qaeda's operational strategy, which involved operations with multiple cells having to sort of lay dormant for long periods of time. This involved an enormous amount of trust inside within the organization. If you're going to spend 2 years in America waiting for green light to do a particular thing, you had to be fairly certain that the other people in the plot, and you might not even know, were doing the same and were similarly committed. So the role of the training camps was extremely important. And in 2002, many people said, well, Al-Qaeda may have lost the training camps after the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, but they now have the internet. So the internet has now replaced the training camps. But I think they were wrong, and the reason is that there's a crucial difference between these two safe havens. The training camps generated very, very strong social links, whereas the internet really can only generate weak personal links. And I think this is very, very important to keep in mind, particularly when you're dealing with clandestine activism. These jihadi internet forums, they put a lot of people in touch. But because the sort of activity they're envisaging is criminal, and because they have so many security services after them, it's very dangerous for someone to rely on, to trust in someone they met on the internet. And the fact that these forums have become increasingly impenetrated by security services in the past few years, the strength of the ties that can be generated by these forums, I think, has decreased even further. And I think this ties into David's earlier point about how weak ties can actually inhibit the diffusion of a movement. So, and another final problem that I'll mention here, which has to do with the internet's ability to spread ideology, is the well-known sort of is Granovetter's idea of homophilia, that people seek out, people tend to be most closely related with people who know the same things as themselves and who already think what they think, and this is well known from other parts of the internet. So you have all these jihadi websites, but you're only going to go to them and stay on these websites if you like what you see, if you're already at a relatively advanced stage of radicalization. So it doesn't really matter how radical the material on these forums is, as long as it doesn't spread to through weak links to other people. So the internet really, and these forums really, I think, serve primarily to entrench existing views among already very committed people. This limits, of course, the spread. So I think that the emerging consensus on the internet and terrorism is that the internet is powerful, but really only as a supplement to face-to-face networking. And this makes sense, because in reality, most people are not isolated individuals sitting in front of a computer, but people have a computer, but they also have friends in school and elsewhere. And you see this pattern in many different cases of jihadi radicalization. People radicalizing groups, the bunch of guy rules still hold, but they but the bunches of guys use the internet together, download the propaganda, etc. So I'll just stop here and look forward to a great discussion.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Well, so for Andrew's sake, I'd like to be able to say I'm going to transition sort of smoothly from Thomas and Tammy, but to a larger extent, I'm going to actually sort of pull off of what we've talked about before in kind of the Obama campaign and sort of the intersection between networking and narrative. And it's a quick background. So the organization that I run is called Change.org. It's an online media network, sort of raising awareness about major social issues and connecting people to opportunities for action. And the vision behind this was, you know, about 3 years ago, we saw the beginning of the rise of the social web in a really robust way. And we thought it was a huge opportunity because looking back, you saw sort of activism for the past 20, 30 years has primarily been a sort of a function of activism by proxy, right? So people don't actually take direct action, at least in national legislation themselves. They have an interceding sort of organization like an Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch or whatever organization it might be, act on their behalf. And their action is really basically just voting with their dollar, right? So you have the direct mail system, people get information exclusively from that organization, they cut a check, and the organization does what it does on a national level. And the reason this was the case is pretty basic, right? You have sort of three major constraints for individuals creating sort of dynamic self-organizations, especially on a national level. You have one, an information issue, right? Just lack of information about what's going on nationally or internationally and what the issue is in a federal government. The second is organization, right? So the impossibility of saying, well, it may be the case that we have 100,000 people spread across the country who really care about the issue of human trafficking, but they sure as heck can't connect to each other in any sort of efficient way. The barriers to organization are extremely high, right? So Clay Shirky writes us about this a lot. Really, really high organizational costs. And the third is sort of action. The inability to take really powerful action, at least on national legislation, the sense of that if you're somebody sitting in sort of Iowa, right? And so because of those three reasons, you really had a system of largely, you know, activism by proxy, by major organizations. And I think the social web, as it sort of rose over the past maybe 4 or 5 years, we saw a unique opportunity to sort of address all three of those problems in a really interesting way, right? So first, on the information side, you had sort of radical sort of, you know, equal access to information and propagation of information from people outside of traditional news sources, right? So not just media, not just traditional organizations, but on sort of on blogs, which is the most prominent, the Rise of the Netroots, and distribution information among people, and accessibility, sort of international news. You could actually read the New York Times online. I mean, these are very basic, but fundamentally different. So the exposure information is radically increased by people, passively and actively. The second is organization, right? So whereas it was previously impossible for, you know, 300,000 people who really cared about homelessness across the country in different pockets to connect among each other, now they can do so, clearly extremely easily connect to like-minded souls on the web. And the third part is action, right? So the rise of tools to directly contact legislators, to directly lobby, to pressure relevant actors on pieces of legislation or whatever pieces of power they're trying to address. And because of that, we saw, look, this is a radical transformation. And we thought that the web would disintermediate to a large extent old organizations, really radically transform existing organizations, and most interestingly, enable the creation of dynamic sort of groups of people coming together, sort of along like-minded interests, sharing information together, and collectively starting and running actions. That's actually, we started change at all on that premise. The premise that you can go to the site, you can start any sort of, you know, issue community you want, you dynamically connect to anybody, frictionless, across the world, across the web, right, that shares a similar interest. You immediately share through publishing tools information, and you have a tool set previously accessible only to large organizations to start national campaigns, lobbying groups, right? And we thought this would be this radically powerful thing. And then, of course, we also enabled tools for nonprofits to change the way in which they worked, to better engage their constituents, to allow sort of a bilateral relationship where it's constituents, instead of just sort of an asymmetric relationship, receiving information, could communicate back in a more sort of symmetric way, right? Generally speaking, we were wrong. Right, so this theory was basically wrong. So this is our lesson learned. So we launched the first version of the site 2 years ago. A lot of interest and sort of buzz within this space, within sort of the activism and nonprofit space. We worked with a ton of organizations. So we worked with Amnesty and ACLU and Humane Society and Greenpeace and Nature Conservancy, and most of the big brands that were sort of vaguely interested in getting involved in networking. And what we found is, so two things, right? So one was on the organic generation of networks, and the second is the implementation of these tools by nonprofits. What we found, the organization dynamically, is that sort of, as Marshall said, leadership matters, narrative really matters, deep engagement, recurring sort of ongoing organization, extremely important. And so what you'd have is you'd have sort of people start these little groups, and you know, they just sort of, they'd start and they'd kind of go for a few days, and they might go for, you know, a week or two or even a month. The person who started them overall would attenuate, the group itself wouldn't have really deep engagement. They'd sort of join, and the question was, what's next? And you lacked a sense of expertise, you lacked sort of ongoing engagement, opportunities for action, and really narrative. And it was, you know, it was sort of a model that we tried and then we failed. The second thing is a more ambiguous, I think, question, which is, you know, how has this impacted organizations? It certainly hasn't impacted them in the sort of radical way we'd like, but you have two sorts of things, right? So one is new organizations, and the second is sort of how it's impacted existing bureaucracies. As far as new organizations, you do have, every so often, I should say, you know, you'll have these outliers that will gain sort of significant prominence in the writings of the guys like Clay Shirky and others, where it seems like this really organic, dynamic groups of people coming together are extremely powerful. And what we realize, if we really dig into it, is everyone's giving the same five examples. And almost every time when they give those examples, that dynamic network turned into an organization that was then very hybrid and top-down in many ways. So the best example initially was Move On. Right, Move On was sort of one of the first sort of dynamic, organic sort of networks. First of all, it was started by a few people that largely sort of spread the development. But second of all, it's turned into largely a somewhat top-down hybrid model of organization. Another example, it was fairly recent, 2007, was Step It Up campaign. It's a sort of national movement to create these local acts of sort of raising awareness about the importance of climate change. Amazing sort of grassroots effort by like 7 students at the University of Vermont. Really powerful, but what they do next, you know, they start an organization. It's called 350.org, right? And it's just, you know, they have leadership, they have messaging, they have, you know, a big email list, and that's a primary means of communication. So it's not as if it's some sort of, it just stayed as this dynamic network. And just recently there's one other, it's Join the Impact, sort of spawning right out of, so you have these interesting things, spawning out of the sort of Prop 8, some say debacles, controversy in California. You had the lack of sort of formal organizations effectively addressing this, and so you did have a grassroots swelling of sort of dynamic support around, you know, express advocacy in a more aggressive way. But it was a bunch of people, but really they've started an organization around it, Join the Impact, right? And it's just like it's a normal organization. More grassroots than traditional, but still an organization nonetheless. It didn't, you know, stay like purely networked and decentralized, right? And then the way it's impacted sort of new organizations that have come up, the best example by far, of course, is the Obama campaign. And I think there's sort of surprisingly either misinformation or just misunderstanding about the nature of the campaign and its both networked functions and narrative. And I think it's pretty clear if you talk to people on the team, I mean, narrative was by far the most important. And network sort of came second. Now, not entirely, there's sort of a lot of groundswell of support and energy and excitement, but you know, it wasn't, I mean, my Barack Obama was not the Obama campaign. Sort of the proper conception is these people that just dynamically come together and start their own groups. It happened to some extent, but to a large extent, it was sort of a top-down organization, and I think a very effective way, an incredibly beautiful narrative, right? Incredibly well done, providing a framework in which people could act in very specific ways. So it's not that they didn't have power, but it's also not that the campaign said, look, go do what you can do, and drum lots of support, right? It was like, on a specific day, in a specific way, with a particular message, go do this, right? And it was really effective, and I think that's what you're going to start seeing in additional organizations, and that's what we see. So, sort of a next step of what we see this evolving into is you see a lot of existing bureaucratic organizations. I don't mean that terribly disparagingly or somewhat. I mean like some of our sort of partners, I mean like an Amnesty or others, is they're looking at these tools, right, the Obama campaign used, and they're saying, well, we want that too, right? So how do we get that as well? And they'll go on the contract, I mean the sort of well-known contract in the space is Blue State Digital powered a lot of the Obama campaign, but if you talk to the team, it's funny, they can sell the tool set, but that's hardly it. And what you see is, it's almost like, you know, these three problems are sort of information and engagement, right, organization and action. The organization side, the connecting people in a really networked way to allow share information and spread a message, that's been commoditized largely. We are already networked. I mean, my guess would be, at least for most of us on this, you know, sort of here in this room, we're all on Facebook, we're all really deeply networked. These sort of offline networks have been explicitly articulated online. So the potential for dissemination of information and sort of connections and collective action is really massive. The problem is the lack of quality narrative and content and actions for people to lay on top of that infrastructure, right? So you have an organization like Amnesty that may have sort of a lot of people networked across the web on different social sites, and their limitation is not tools. It's not online networking. It's a really compelling message to be able to propagate across that network. Because if they do that, people will spread it, right? And there's sort of the mechanisms by which they can do so. So what we see, sort of, I think the exciting thing we see right now in the space, we sort of changed the order major personally, is you have an incredible amount of interest in change, broadly speaking, right? I think sort of clearly accentuated, but really just illuminated by the Obama movement. But you have a chasm between that interest and the ability to sort of take really practical, powerful action to be feel like you're a part of a movement for a cause you care about, right? So sort of valence, kind of vague connections people have to these issues they're getting increasingly exposed to because of information flows. I mean, we all know about Darfur. I mean, the reason, of course, everyone thinks right now, if you ask people sort of how much violence or conflict there is around the world, they think it's, you know, it's an incredible amount relative to previous times. And of course, it's the exact opposite. Right? Many, many fewer conflicts, much less death and destruction. We just know about it a lot more, right? And we're much more sympathetic, and I think empathetic because of the connections we have and the radical information access that we have. But for us to really engage and do something, and not just have, you know, millions of people connected around sort of, you know, general interests, but take powerful collective action, I think it's going to take narrative and it's going to take powerful ways to get involved. And the problem with this is that nonprofits are kind of bad at both. Nonprofits tend to be bad at narrative, and then they're really bad at empowering people to take action. I mean, if you talk to like our partners on a regular basis, they'll want us to run campaigns for them on our site. And I just had, I won't call them out, I had a nonprofit, very big nonprofit mentioned earlier today, that I haven't mentioned yet, that literally, so we're on this campaign and it's trying to increase the access of sort of efficacy of foreign assistance in Afghanistan and across the country, or across the world in developing nations. And it was targeting a few representatives. And so we set up the campaign and we're running this campaign. And he said, oh, it's a petition, right? Not, it doesn't actually email the representatives. I was like, oh, of course it emails them, right? It's actually contacting them. So, oh, no, we don't want that. We don't actually want that. We just want to get lots of people to sign it so we can go and talk to, you know, these representatives ourselves, right? And literally, it's funny. You talk to these organizations, and I think it's a real problem. It's a real problem because you have a groundswell of support of people interested, amenable to action. And then you just, I mean, our theory was initially just connect them to opportunities for action. And nonprofits are like, well, we don't know what to do with them. I mean, for most organizations, I mean, I was talking about Human Rights Watch. Like, if I gave you a million people, if you're human, like, what do you do with those people? Like, they don't know. And it's not their, I mean, that's just not their model. Their model is, we go do research, we're experts, and we, I mean, but even Amnesty, you know, 30 years ago, I think with local offices and grassroots support, they might have had easy things to say, and I know some of the guys would disagree with me, but there's not like this clear plug and play like the Obama campaign had where, hey, give me a million people, like this is what you do, right? And partially it's a function of what you work on, right? So if you're working on international development or international aid issues, it's just hard. So anyway, so transition is sort of the model we've embraced over the past year, is one much more focused on addressing what we think is the real core need, which is not the organizational sort of networking part, which is we'll use, but it's a commodity, I think, largely. It's the narrative that deeply engages people and tells them why this matters and what they can do, really basic. Right? Why this matters and what they can do. And so we've organized this site really instead of just dynamic networks, almost like in a, you know, Obama-like way. In some ways, we've built channels around focused issues, right? So global warming, or gay rights, or homelessness, or, you know, global health. And the problem we see in the space is there are all these people coming and saying, I care about making a difference, what do I do? And nobody really taking their hand and walking through the process. And so that's exactly what we try to do. So I think the interesting thing, sort of, it seems unsexy, but the interesting thing is sort of, I mean, new media, is the means by which we communicate and the ways in which we communicate and engage people, and I think narrative is a large part of that. I think we talk about narrative in a bit different way than Marshall and others. I mean, it's more scaled. It's not on an individual basis, everyone with their own story. But we have these communities where, if you care about engagement, right, care about engagement through information, traditional news media is your enemy, right? Objectivity is your enemy. Now, I don't want to say we're not truthful. We're certainly truthful, but if you care about engaging somebody in human trafficking, right, the kind of stories you're going to read about, one, extraordinarily rare, right, in mainstream media. Two, they're terribly boring. Three, they don't have that much expertise because it's somebody who's got a beat who is doing metro work and it happens to be that there's a brothel broken in sort of a local area, right? And three, there's limited ink, right? So you write about it once and that's it. There's no continuity. So our model is basically, how do you raise awareness about, build movements around sort of narrative and self-consciousness around these major issues that get a dearth of coverage? And even if they get decently covered, they're not covered in the way that really engages and deeply sort of motivates people. And I think that the messaging of the Obama campaign did that, felt people, made people feel they're part of something greater than themselves. That's really what people mean. People didn't want to, everyone didn't want to just start their own organization. They wanted to be plugged in. And that's what we're trying to sort of give as well. So some of that, just to identify a few things, like for the channels, we run, I'd say, our homelessness sort of community on the site. We have people who are formerly homeless blog on a regular basis about their experience. There was a beautiful piece written by one of our bloggers who wrote on Thanksgiving Day about sort of, it was about 15 years ago, and it was the first day in his life, having sort of been homeless for about 3 or 4 months, that he came to realize and accept he was homeless, and it was when he first had to push a cart, right? And the depths and sort of the nadir, like the awful tragedy that was in his life and sort of the fear he had out of that. And we've got people, criminal justice, we just had somebody write a story, his story, about being in jail for 23 years. He is blogging from prison. He was incarcerated. He's incarcerated for 40 years for distribution of cocaine. Nonviolent, but distribution of a whole lot of cocaine. And it's tragic. I mean, we've got people on autism. One of our bloggers is autistic. She's amazing. She's high-functioning autistic, talking about her experience, talking about this. So sort of the deep engagement you get with these sorts of, the kind of personality, the kind of engagement and writing we do, I think, you know, technically it seems like it's not specific to new media, but the accessibility of publishing platforms and our ability to go connect to these people that aren't formal experts and journalists, but have amazing stories and have deep experience and expertise in this are, you know, are really powerful. And I got to call out, you know, one of our actually editors who's in the back of the room, Mike Jones, you know, works at sort of the law school. And I mean, the number of, you know, sort of, you know, so he writes the gay rights blog, sort of LGBT issues. And a couple things. One is we have, you know, some transsexual actually writing on the site every so often, which is a radical sort of adjustment for lots of people. They don't have access to that narrative. They have access to that sort of personal connection. But also, our model is, you know, you write good enough content, it gets distributed across the web in ways that traditionally, you know, gay rights articles are usually about he said this, she said that, and it's, you know, it's sort of like focus on the family versus what I would say normal people. Not to disparage anybody, and it's just objective. It's like one says is this and one says is that. If you want to mobilize people around a major issue like that, you've got to be hard-hitting on a regular basis, create a narrative, and do it every day. And that's what we're trying to do. And the last thing I guess I'd say is, so where we see this going is, that's a model we've developed, is basically deep engagement and sort of raising awareness of major causes. And the next step is how we, you know, empower people to take really powerful action. And this is something I don't claim to sort of have satisfied yet. We'd like to lean on our nonprofit partners. We have 100 nonprofits signing up every week, ostensibly to come in and post opportunities to get involved. So theoretically, we crowdsource then all the opportunities for engagement from nonprofits, show you the most powerful ways to get involved and send you on your way. So help sort of feed the nonprofit sector. The problem is most nonprofits don't have powerful ways to get involved. So along with that, I mean, that's, I'd be interested in anyone else's thoughts. I know a lot of, I mean, a number of people like Ben at Avaaz have sort of worked on this. Yeah, that's the model we're at now.
Does anyone have a question? Joe.
I wanted to make a comment on what Ben was saying. I think it's really interesting. So I run Facebook Causes, and we and I'll talk about this more later, but I think we started under a lot of the same assumptions that Ben did about, you know, that basically, you know, all, well, what this new technology allowed you to do is, A, form groups really quickly, right? Like, really simple, really fast, really massive group formation is something we started to take for granted, but which is hugely different. But the idea that, like, you can get, like, 5 million people to care about cancer in a group in 1 month. And into a group, I just mean signed up, right? It's not, that might not mean anything more than them signing up, right? So then you get into this question of, like, what the hell do they all do once they're there? And I think that what I think actually what you're saying and also what you've discarded, well, what you've sort of moved past, which I think is where we still are, so maybe we're like slow. But I think that is that you can actually create a more of a marketplace for better run groups. So it's not that you get a new group and all of a sudden just stuff happens, it's that leadership forms and structures form, but it opens up more opportunities for more people to become those leaders, right, and to create those structures. So I think that, you know, what a system like ours will do, like, you guys have basically, and you can tell me if this is wrong or too simplistic, you guys basically become a set of nonprofits, essentially. Like, what you guys have, each of your network is essentially a global warming nonprofit, in the sense that it is a activist group about global warming, which ostensibly competes with the Alliance for Climate Protection and all these other guys, and you're sort of meta and that you're kind of drawing the stuff together. But essentially you're competing with them and you're basically having a better model. So people out there are like, man, I want to do something about global warming. You guys are saying, well, we have better stuff to do than these other guys do. And the reason you're able to do that is because this technology allows you to rise to scale very quickly. And so, or whether it's Donors Choose or Kiva or any of these guys, that you're going to see more and more nonprofits that A, are smart about using networking, and B, are like much more transparent and much better storytelling. I mean, Donors Choose, which I don't know if people are familiar with, is a group that, you know, lets you donate directly to teachers. Kiva is a microfinance group. Both of these are about storytelling. It's about this specific dude in Bangladesh that is starting, like, you know, a goat selling operation or whatever. That's probably a horrible example. That's ultimately about storytelling. And so I think that you're gonna just see. And it's funny, like, you talk to these nonprofits, and you've had this experience too, where, like, these are people who, on the ground, are often very good grassroots organizers, but when they get online, they just, like, get stupid. It's basically the same stuff. Like, they just get online, and they suddenly just sort of, like, what do I do? And actually, it's do what you've been doing on the ground when you're successful. Just do it online.
Yeah. One thing I'd respond to is just saying, and echo the power that you're talking about. Like, it's incredibly amazing the possible scale in such an immediate way. We've talked a lot about, you know, sort of how things develop, you know, how things spread, but I think the web is right now one of the most interesting and powerful things about the web is the possibility of virality. And, you know, Joe knows about this sort of better than anybody sort of in the space, but it's really, this is not like, you know, one person spreading it to another and over time it eventually organically develops. It's like massive viral exponential growth mathematically, right? Massive, massive growth. And I think that what we see is sort of this chasm being, so there's a clear opportunity here. What's remarkable though to me still is that, like, none of us have really got, well, how do you translate that into actual, like, dramatic impact? Because, I mean, the Obama campaign has been a great example of the possibility of using both narrative and networking as a supplemental tool to have real, obviously real world impact. But we don't see, like, a radical transformation. I would have guessed, right, I would have guessed 5 years ago, that if you told me, look, you can get groups of millions of people coming together dynamically in immediate ways, right? So there's a Facebook, you know, there's a, you know, a million people Barack Obama on Facebook, right? Or a million strong for Barack Obama on Facebook, right? And immediately sort of, you know, 300,000 people grew, right? This is like right after the sort of the announcement. And like literally it just went kaput pretty much after that. And part of the reason was they didn't have means of true communicating with, yeah.
I should say though, the campaign basically brought them in. Like,
yeah.
The campaign smartly went to those kids. Like, I remember there was a rally in Oakland in March of 2007.
They mobilized.
where the guys were like, the Obama campaign were working out of our conference room, and my office's conference room, and they had, like, when we went to the greeting, the Obama, like, greeting afterwards, like, the people who helped out, you know, the handshaking, most of the people there were student leaders who they had found through this group.
Yeah.
Right, so they had brought these guys in,
yeah,
which was really smart, instead of the old school thing, which is to, like, yeah, we don't control you, go away.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you know, bring them in, make them part of the campaign.
Yeah.
But bring them into the top 10 organization. I mean, all of the, you know, the untold story of Obama, I think, or part of it is that, you know, mybarackobama.com, to the degree it was useful, was essentially a lead generation.
Yeah.
So it was like, here's a bunch of people forming groups. Now, when we move into a new state, like Texas or whatever in the primaries, okay, where do we find our initial volunteers? Where we usually would have gone down to, like, the old Democratic Party office, which we'll still do, now we're also going to look on mybarackobama.com, see the groups that have started, contact those people, and then bring them into our organization.
Yeah.
So the self-organizing was not yet happening online. That's like the 2.0 version. Sorry.
You know a lot about this.
No, I just want to, yeah, just join the band here. So, no, it's very interesting. It's fascinating. Because the your experience is very interesting. And I talk with the meetup people, and a very,
yeah,
similar kind of experience.
Yeah.
So I think an interesting question is, so how do you go beyond that, right? And one other dimension, well, there were two other important dimensions, I think, of the Obama campaign, to use as an example. One is, along with the story, you need a strategy. And a lot of, you know, it's really interesting, because your description of all these groups coming and wanting to, that's how it's been since the election.
Yeah.
On, hey, organizing, you know,
yeah,
and it's like, please give us the magic bullet.
Yeah, we want that.
Yeah, yeah.
Give us community. Can you give us community?
Yeah, exactly. No, it's pretty amazing. So on the one hand, it's a teaching moment.
Yeah.
It's an opening. It's an opportunity. On the other hand, it underscores that, you know, there's real change involved in doing things different. I mean, that sounds silly to say, but, you know, a lot of organizations have gotten so embedded in the marketing model, and so used to operating under conditions of constraint and scarcity that they can't think expansively. And they can't think, it's like politics of disappointment versus politics of hope. Politics of disappointment, boy, you got your critical eye out there. How soon am I going to be let down? What, you know, I got to be very risk averse. Politics of hope is, hey, I'm going to roll the dice. I got a chance to do something. There's a real shift in the moment that a lot of these organizations just have not caught up with, because they survived under very different conditions, and they're not able to embrace this. So that comes. There are two points I want to make. One is the Obama campaign had a very clear strategic objective: elect Obama. Okay. And then it could break down into roles at a state level, at a local level, so on and so forth. If you know, you go to change, you know, the We campaign, you know, the Gore's campaign. Well, maybe there's 53 things you can do, right? Oh, here, let me give you a menu of things. Well, each one becomes utterly trivial. See, now the marketing mentality is, oh, by giving lots of choices, everybody will find something that they want to do, and it'll match up with individual preferences, and isn't that great? But that's not how you build movements. You build movements out of commitment, out of focus, out of synergy, out of concentration, out of mindfulness, out of intentionality, and for that, you're looking for commonality. You're trying to do just the opposite. And so instead of all this market differentiation, you're trying to figure out how out of diversity do we bring the common focus. Now the campaign did that very, very richly because it focused on shared values rather than issues. And by creating broad values foundations, people from all kinds of different issue positions came into contact with one another, and it would really be clear in like Camp Obama training sessions where people would really just be excited about being released from their issue silo. And sort of, you know, I don't have to be a bird person here. I could just be a person and work with other people on behalf of the environment, so on and so forth. So there's a real strategic problem in so many advocacy groups right now. I mean, it's quite amazing. It's as if Dr. King had the night of the month, you know, first night of the Montgomery bus boycott, said, well, we're for American justice, God's justice, racial justice, and so let's go out there and do it, and here's 43 ways you can. He said, well, there's one way. We're going to desegregate buses in Montgomery, Alabama. That's our focus. And somebody would come along and say, well, hey, I want to do schools, you know, because that's where I think, and I want to do, you know, public accommodations. Say, well, you know, join the club because we're going to, this is our focus. And it's that capacity to focus, you know, resources collectively on strategic objectives that gives a movement power.
and allows it to use its resources powerfully. So that's number one, and I really get what you're saying. I mean, that's just, the strategy stuff is crazy making. The other thing is that, the other thing the campaign invested in, you know, there were 2,500 organizers, and those, they were doing something. And a lot of what they were doing was training local leadership teams. Where the campaign was very significantly different from most advocacy efforts, and most like sort of let's go all mobilize and, or let's all go show up at one place at one time, was they actually invested in developing teams of leaders at local levels with real autonomy, able to do strategy, able to set goals, able to adapt, able to learn from one another. And that creation of that collective leadership capacity of the base was really, I think, what birthed so much of the energy of the movement. It took the motivational energy and translated it into structures through which people could actually do stuff. And that's what we would do in the Camp Obama trainings, like a Friday through Sunday, is bring individuals together, teach them the public narrative, but then how to form relationships, how to do one-on-one meetings, how to do all that, how to structure themselves so that they could strategize and then produce actions that they could hold themselves accountable. The internet tools were provided a level of transparency that I'd never experienced before, where a local group could get access to a voter file, and somebody in Chicago could see actually what the local group was doing, which is great, because it sort of takes it all out of the shadows and allows you to really see. Another one is tools that helped local groups coach. In other words, if you think, okay, how far can I push the internet to provide coaching that through which people can begin to acquire leadership skills? But see, this thing about the myth of self-organization, people come together and they think leadership's being an alpha male, and so that's who takes leadership, and then that's often exactly who you don't want to take leadership. And it's just, but a skilled intervention at that, and really thinking about how people could be tutored through that process. I'm doing a distance learning version of my organizing class. We're going to start in May. It's an experiment to see what we can do. And it's because what we teach is interpersonal skills. This is the stuff I was talking about. So we're having people sign up as teams. And so that we're going to, in other words, provide a lot of visual and some real-time coaching and models. We use a lot of visual stuff. And then have them video what they're doing and then give them feedback on what they're doing. Because we're sort of starting from the assumption that this is not about individuals, it's about collective action. And so the way you learn to do collective work is like the way you learn to ride a bicycle. You don't read about it, you do it. And you fail, but then you can succeed if you've got good coaching and support. So I think thinking about how to nurture that sort of thing, how to provide tools that will nurture that sort of thing, could be extremely productive. As well as the problem of the strategy issue, which I totally recognize.
Hey, Marshall, and to use one of your tactics of public accountability, one thing I would ask or suggest is one thing that could be interesting is with this distance learning class made me think of, what if you took a couple of the Facebook causes that have, we have some really interesting small campaigns that have been started that have gotten great traction and I think could really use coaching, and what if as part of that class you took a couple Facebook causes and had them, you know, in using, you know, Arjun said and lots of other tool sets, help these groups that have come together already online, you know, already over a distance, and have made some traction, but are now like, we've got these 100,000 members of our cause, a million members of our cause, now what do we do with them?
Well, let's talk afterwards. No, I think just one last thing, that there was a real spirit of experimentation around the campaign that I think was very unusual in a lot of political campaigns, where it's all just conventional wisdom and that's what you do. There was a lot of new stuff tried, and that's the same thing I'm hearing here. And that is the kind of time we're in right now. So there's a tremendous learning opportunity here if we, you know, if we take advantage of it, if we talk to each other, and kind of, you know, we're in an amazing moment right now.
Can I ask you guys, I'll go back to the audience in just one second, but I'm going to put two of these questions together and ask you, go back to what Marshall said about the role of YouTube in storytelling in the campaign. And I think actually every one of you guys mentioned the role of storytelling as slightly different in the internet era, and Tammy described how structures, it's not that the media is the message, but the media determines how big the message can be or who the message will affect, whether they're government structures or online media structures. So the question that Ben poses is, compare your advice about YouTube storytelling in the Obama campaign to bad congressional websites, which we looked at earlier in the day. What is different about storytelling in a Web 2.0 medium as compared to Web 1.0? And Manish responds, websites and apps like Wurl allow people to build a story with their connections in real time. It's collective, connected, instant narration. And I just quoted you, Marshall, earlier saying the more visual the story, the more powerful the story. And I didn't know if you meant visual in the sense of YouTube is presenting images in my face, or you meant in the same way that, you know, a book could be deeply visual. So I didn't know if you meant like, if, you know, evokes images in one's head or actually presents images in front of their eyes. So I would love to hear from you guys as well as anyone else about how we think the internet and especially 2.0 technologies are making storytelling new, different, better, worse.
Well, Sam Graham Kelson, you know Sam?
Yeah.
You know, blogger in chief of the campaign, totally got story. And so, you know, they were out collecting stories all the time. And then the stories were being deployed very purposefully. Now, these were people telling their stories. And they were of value to motivate, they were of value to teach, sort of how house meetings work and stuff like that. And so it was a very, but again, There was a purpose for doing it. It wasn't just like, oh, let's put it out there and see what happens. It was a very purposeful dimension to it. And I thought, what I meant by visual is that, I mean, you know, episodic memory grows out of the capacity to visualize. And so if I'm telling you a story and I make it as visible as I can to you through the words that I use in the description and I put it in the present tense and I got colors and names and shapes, it's going to be much more powerful. When you can take a picture, when you can show somebody doing that, that's more powerful. And so it's not so much about showing what the person's describing as it is the way the person describes the story very vividly that allows you to empathetically connect to the storyteller and in that way experience. Now, I mean, you can also, obviously, that's what movies do, is tell stories visually. And so, but the point I was just trying to make is that visualization of a narrative gives it its power. It's like the more concrete, the more particular. It's like a poem. You access transcendence through the particular. And that's how you get to the values experience that you're trying to get at by being very, very specific about the moment.
Is there connection to YouTube, I guess? I mean, does that change?
Well, I mean, the other thing I saw about YouTube, just two things. Within the campaign, there was this amazing competition between Ohio and Pennsylvania, right towards the end. You know about that?
Yeah.
It was like the two campaign teams challenged each other. There was all this trash talking going back and forth about who was going to do more door knocks the weekend before the campaign. And it was no Yo Mama and no it. And one side enlisted Barack and the other side enlisted Michelle. And it was all this whole thing going on with cartoons and pictures back and forth. And you could never. I mean, it was very cool. But it was a playful use of this technology in a wonderfully kind of spirited, motivational way. The South Carolina staff all did videos. They did this video the night before the Iowa primary and sent it off to the Iowa staff so they could see the South Carolina people doing chants for them and giving them support. And so it has this motivational content and capacity because of the visual dimension of it. The other thing with YouTube was it opened up the creativity in the campaign, in and out and around the campaign. And so that became an instrument for that was just enriched it tremendously.
Just the one comment I'd say about sort of YouTube is you said YouTube is amazing. It's really like, it's basically benign sort of infrastructure, right? And without good content, YouTube
exactly.
doesn't matter at all.
Exactly.
Right? You sort of look at like,
exactly.
if you basically had this sort of, you know, congressional website that
yeah.
you saw up there, and you have, you know, C-SPAN on there, it's going to be generally, if it's just showing like a debate, really damn boring.
Right.
And so the innovativeness is really sort of the authenticity, the personality,
yes.
the real-time nature of it, that you got, you know, Barack just like sat down in front of a camera and just, you know, 10 hours later you see it directly. So now you'll see things like, you know, at the end of the campaign, you get this, oh my God, this amazing access, and it seems so two-way and dynamic. And really, it's kind of the veneer of dynamism, right? I mean, you're not really, and most people aren't interacting. Just the feeling that you could comment, that you could post your own video, and the vast, vast minority, less than 1%, actually did anything, right, beyond just feel like they're a part of it. And the fact that they could, made you feel that? And this is innovative things like, you know, like on the email, most of it's email driven largely, right? I mean, it's capturing leads through sort of things like My Barack Obama, but really email driven, narrative driven. And you'd have things like the matching donation, right? Where, you know, you go on, you can make a donation, you can see actually, oh, you're matching somebody else's previous donation. And it wasn't really participatory, I felt like it. And so anyway, just incredible content and narrative and manufacturing of that sense of community.
Where it was given the authenticity that it was actually happening at the grassroots.
Right.
I mean, it was actually, there was a real thing there. And so your point about amplification, that's what was so powerful.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question about democratization and top-down versus bottom-up, particularly on something that Ben said about how few people were actually interacting, at least in that regard. If we're talking about top-up and bottom-up, top-down, it seems to me that there one might get the impression that a lot of this new media campaigning is really much done by affluent, educated, and for the most part, white people, rather than a real bottom up. I wonder if any of the panelists could direct this, or answer this, or address this.
I just note, MoveOn.org is, I think, added hundreds of thousands of African American members during the campaign, and it's now more diverse than the rest of them. There are more African Americans are overrepresented in MoveOn's membership. I don't know if that's true of the Obama list, but there's certainly some connectivity gap, but generally, I think, you know, previous to sort of the rise of things like small donor funded campaigns were much more funded by people who had lots of money, and now it's pushed. You know, people with very little can contribute a little bit. People who have, you know, middle class folks are vastly more engaged. So it might not flip a pyramid upside down, but it could at least turn it into more of a, I don't know, pear shape or something like that.
Yeah, I guess it depends what you mean by bottom up and top down. I mean, we did a series of Latino Camp Obamas in 4 states in August that were all focused on outreach to Latino communities in 14 states, and there the internet was less helpful, right?
Because the Latino community is not as internet savvy.
Because low income, and especially among new immigrants, had less access. On the other hand, it was still helpful. I mean, so, you know, it's a question of, is that, in other words, are you describing who has access and who doesn't have access? Or are you describing how people organize locally and how that relates to national purposes?
Well, I mean, for example, this group today is predominantly white, right? And it's interesting that, you know, how does this affect the actual democratization as opposed to intention?
Yeah. No,
that's my question.
And as I love to say, remember, the blogosphere is actually disproportionately white, right? I mean, overrepresented. So this is not a trivial problem. And yeah, I mean, it's...
So it's Harvard.
It's probably about equal. Anyway, I don't know.
Harvard is certainly predominantly economically well off.
Controversial statement.
Relevant in its racial sense, it is absolutely economically well.
But there, I mean, the point is an important one, that you know, for the well-resourced to be better connected is just to be better resourced. I mean, but that's the digital divide issue, I guess. Is this just making the powerful more powerful? And exaction,
I guess,
you know,
that's the question I'm asking.
Distinction or not? I don't know. I guess my view is that I think that may be a challenge of how to use this stuff in such a way that it that we change that.
I'd say one last thing. I'd say it's a question of absolutes versus relative. So absolutely speaking, sort of abstractly, there's still sort of an overrepresentation of sort of well-off, especially sort of white, relative to what we had before. I'd say 4 years ago, 8 years ago, 12 years ago, because of things like, I mean, one of the most sort of vibrant networks online is Mi Gente, which is you know, sort of a Latino kind of social network. And I know the campaign tried to engage in sort of Mi Gente and Black Planet and the sort of other sort of networks that had sort of a lot of minorities. And so it may not, again, be sort of representative, but more so than it previously was, and I think that's the progress.
Now, one traditionally underrepresented group that it actually did amplify the voice of was young people. I mean, because the generational dimension to the campaign was huge. And that was surely amplified by access to these tools.
Of course, it might have been at the expense of old people, because old people have greater difficulty with, you know, with these very highly digitalized things.
No, I mean, so, you know, we need to learn how to use this stuff. I mean, it's,
easier said than done.
No, but the interesting thing is, of course, older people, we don't say old people, elders, traditionally vote, participate more. Young people don't. This was sort of a one vehicle that I think facilitated that.
Let's take one last question. I'll let Tammy speak, and then we'll take one last question, and then take a quick break, and then move on to the last panel.
I just wanted to link this really quickly with explicitly with narrative, in that, like, asking about the sort of diversity of voices that are able to access or participate in narratives that are sort of being presented. And it sort of gets back to Mark's point about, my mind just went totally blank. I can't tell you what your point was, but sorry. About the sort of richness or the visualization of narrative. Narratives are not going to be successful at pulling in people for participation unless they can actually read their own stories within that existing narrative. So you can't make a story out of whole cloth for people that's going to be convincing to compel them to act. They have to sort of be able to read themselves. So, I mean, to ask about sort of democratization is in part the question about the digital divide or whatever, but after you get past a certain level of barrier participation, whether people then enjoin that narrative is going to depend on whether that narrative successfully speaks to them given their pre-existing story and idea of themselves. And to the extent that it does, then maybe that kind of, like, the sort of elitism or whatever may not matter as much, because if that whoever created that narrative or took part in shaping that narrative has not managed to frame it in such a way that speaks across, you know, socioeconomic or racial divides, then people will go to other spaces and form other narratives, counter narratives that are going to challenge that existing narrative. So if it works, it works.
Any other questions?
Could I just have?
Yeah, please.
I wanted to comment on your presentation, which I found very interesting. This morning you talked about Dan McAdams' work. Dan McAdams' very interesting work on narrative constructs. And one of them is about the narrative response to loss. And the sort of two narrative responses to loss. One is a story of redemption, where loss turns out to be a portal to renewal. The other is the story of contamination, where loss becomes a predictor of what inevitably happens. And he sort of links stories of contamination with fundamentalist reactions, whereas stories of redemption are like, they're more resilient and forward-going. And I have a colleague at Berkeley that did a study of US and British labor movements in terms of civil rights and labor. The power of the Christian narrative in the civil rights movement to explain loss in a redemptive way offered real resilience to the movement so that it could, but where the labor movement didn't have a way to account for its losses, it sort of led to a break in the story. And then becomes a story of contamination. Oh, we're always going to get screwed. Oh, this is always going to happen. So I don't know. I was sort of thinking, as you were describing Camp Osama, like, as opposed to Camp Obama. I mean, this was like, that's what I was thinking. Those seem to be crucibles where they're doing the storytelling. But is it a story of redemption, or is it a story of contamination, or is it a particular kind of story of redemption? I don't know. It's just a question.
It's a very good question. I don't have a good answer to it. I just think it would be to say that it is a story of redemption. There's a lot of talk in my circles about how these narratives or ideologies are constructed, and a lot of people say that, oh, they're so complicated, it's so sophisticated, they use all these very elaborate theological references. But I think that's completely the wrong way to look at it. The core of these messages are very, very simple. It's a
it's in the case of Camp Osama, the global jihadist, the message is this: the Muslim nation is being humiliated and attacked by non-Muslims, and we are using the fact. All the videos are just long lists of symbols of suffering, symbols of Muslim suffering at the hands of.
And where's the hope? Where's the hope?
The hope is often, there are two ways in which they work this. One is by showing youth resisting. So typically, one Al Qaeda video begins with pictures of sort of US or Israeli attacks on Muslims. Then it shows pictures of the Arab leaders shaking hands with the Western powers, showing how they, the grown-ups of the traitors. And then they show pictures of the of kids throwing stuff. Yeah. So the new generation will continue where the adults have left off. And then they often, at the end, they add something about martyrdom. This will, your self-sacrifice will lead to return to life.
Great. Thanks very much, you guys. And we'll take just maybe 5 minutes to get coffee and then get back to the next panel so we can still end on time.